Hello, everybody. Welcome to Health Chatter. Today's show, we're really digging deep into the medical arena. Today, our show is on pediatric blood disorders. And we have a great guest with us, Dr. Kate Garland. I'll introduce her in just a second. But it'll be interesting because, frankly, I certainly don't know much about this arena, but hopefully by the end of the show, everybody will be a little bit more knowledgeable. I want to thank our crew, as always. They're second to none. Maddie Levine-Wolf, Aaron Collins, and Deandra Howard do our background research. Sheridan Nygaard also does research for us, marketing, and helps us with recording. Matthew Campbell, our production person. And of course, there's Dr. Barry Baines, who's our physician consultant on our show and provides us with good medical insight. Then, of course, there's Clarence. Clarence Jones and I have partnered on this for now close to 3 years, and it's been a wonderful endeavor. And we frankly, even though we've been in the healthcare arena a long time, I think I could speak for you too, Clarence, that, you know, we've learned a lot along the way, and we hope you, the listening audience, does as well. We also have a great partner, sponsor for these shows, the Health Chatter shows, Human Partnership, great community health organization. You could check them out at humanpartnership.org, and we can check us out at healthchatterpodcast.com, and you'll see all the research that we do for the shows there, as well as the transcriptions of the shows. If you'd like to read as opposed to listen to podcasts, you can read about the information on our website. So thanks to everybody. So today we have Dr. Kate Garland. She attended medical school at East Tennessee State University. Actually, I was in Tennessee over the summer. It's an interesting state to visit. She completed her pediatric residency and a chief residency year at Children's Hospital of the King's Daughters in Norfolk, Virginia. She's done a lot of research, and you can tell it's one thing, you know, as I've read her bio, it's one thing to look at a clinician, but it's another thing to also see that they're involved in research. And my sense is that research is hopefully to help make a difference in this arena. She serves as a local principal investigator for multiple large national, international clinical trials, and she's being primed for a future co-director role of the Children's Minnesota Hemophilia Treatment Center here in Minnesota, HTC, right? Hemophilia Treatment Center. So welcome to you, and thank you so much for being part of Health Chatter today. So let me get the ball rolling here, and then believe me, everybody's going to be chiming in on this one. You know, as I read through the background research that our crew provided here, it's like, all right, how is it that you identify somebody who's got any of these pediatric blood disorders? Do they present themselves with particular symptoms? Is it a function of testing, for instance, because there's genetics involved? Help me identify how it is that you, as a clinician, identify somebody who's got a blood disorder.
Well, thank you for having me, everybody, today. It's a true pleasure and honor. So how do you identify somebody with a bleeding disorder? It can be a real, or any sort of blood disorder, really. It can be a real challenge. First, I suppose you have to understand what a blood disorder is. I think what we're going to be talking about today is things that affect the blood or the blood cells that are considered non-malignant, so not cancer, not oncology. And that doesn't mean that they are benign or doesn't affect somebody's life. But in general, if you have something of the blood, they can really be identified two ways. One, you have a family history of it, so maybe there is a genetic component that can be passed down from generation to generation. Or two, you are the brand new patient of the family who happened to get this, It was sort of acquired either genetically or as a result of being exposed to something outside in your life. And really, patients come to us with these things. Our hope as a clinician or as a doctor is to pick up on those patients who maybe have a family history of it so we can counsel and talk about what the future risks are. But aside from that, really, people might come to us with, now I'm bleeding and I don't know why, or now I had a clot and I don't know why, or now I have this pain or rash and I don't know why. And it's our job to figure out why.
So they a level of seriousness, okay, so it's like, okay, I'm bleeding all of a sudden. Well, okay, maybe that'll just heal itself and thank you very much. But at what point does an actual patient present themselves to you? It seems to me that there's got to be this, wait a minute, something's really not right here. So help me with that.
It can be anything from at birth to late in life. So, for instance, if we're talking about bleeding disorders or things in your blood that make you bleed more heavily, sometimes a patient could come to us because the parents noted or a pediatrician noted that with the child's circumcision that they bled too much. Sometimes they come to us because they are now 2 years old and bruising more easily now that they are running around. So they're covered in bruises, which of course can be sometimes misdiagnosed as abuse or missed as abuse. Or sometimes you have teenage girls who really have had no problems throughout their life and they start menstruating and now they have very heavy menses. But these things can be missed because parents and clinicians alike can write it off as I bled a lot, they bleed a lot, I bruised a lot, they bruised a lot, and maybe it's not always picked up until later in life.
All right. So, Clarence, chime in on this one because obviously we're dealing with, some diseases that affect the African American population. Let's talk about, there's kind of this cadre of things here, but treatment. All right. So, in general, are blood disorders treated pretty much the same way, or does each specific blood disorder have a particular treatment that's maybe different from the other one?
Stan, can I let me jump in here real quick? Because I appreciate that. Because I was gonna go kind of go down this lane. I am African American, and all of my life I have heard about sickle cell, and I think that part of the understanding I'd like to know is number one, I don't think that we know much about it, or it's not talked about much in our community, and so when we look or when we hear about sickle cell. And totally honest, what I heard is that they have it, and they're probably going to die soon. Okay, and so I would you kind of explain what it is, and then talk about go back into the treatment of it because I think that sometimes, like I said, it's like the kiss of death. You have sickle cell, you're going to die. You know what I mean? And so I know I know my question is not formed very well, but that's because I don't know. So I hope you understand where I'm trying to go.
Absolutely. Let's talk about what sickle cell is because it certainly is not benign and it's scary and it can be life-threatening and it can be a big change for families when they know about or find out about the diagnosis. So, in your blood, you make cells. We all make three cells: white blood cells that fight infections and carry our body's DNA or genetics. We make platelets that help us to clot and stop bleeding. But then we also make red blood cells, and red blood cells carry the oxygen throughout the body. So their job is to be a little round cell and pick up oxygen in the lungs, transport it throughout the body, deliver the oxygen to the tissues or the organs, pick up the carbon dioxide there, transport it back to the lungs so that you can breathe out the carbon dioxide, and then repeat, pick up an oxygen. In sickle cell, there is, well, I should say, in general, in red blood cells, we all have something that sits inside the red blood cell and gives it its shape. We call it hemoglobin. So this hemoglobin is a protein. So all proteins are made from your DNA. So you have inherited this DNA or genetic structure to build this protein called hemoglobin. Unfortunately, this hemoglobin needs to be a very specific structure in order to be able to do its job or function well of carrying oxygen. And if you have a very slight spelling mistake in that genetic code, which you can inherit, then it makes the hemoglobin less likely to hold on to the oxygen or less likely to pick it up. And when it does pick it up or delivers the oxygen, it deforms. So when the hemoglobin or the red blood cell is not holding on to oxygen, the round red blood cell instead turns into a more sickle type shape. And if a sickle kind of has two points on the end, it kind of looks like a crescent moon. And those pointy ends can cause a lot of damage to the body. And obviously, if you're not carrying oxygen very well, that can also lead to a lot of damage and shorten your life. So sick.
So go ahead.
Go ahead.
So it's like, I keep having all these whys in my head. Why specifically do we connect sickle cell a lot with the African American population? What's going on here?
I don't know if we know exactly why. We know that somewhere along the line there was a genetic change in a human, and that has gotten passed down. And like anything, you get two copies of every gene, one from your mom, one from your dad. And if each copy of the gene is affected, then you are more severely affected because you make no normal shape. There are people that have theorized, and there is some racial bias in this, that maybe this genetic change occurred because a red blood cell that is not normally shaped does not hold oxygen as well, and maybe is harder for certain diseases to infect it. So one of the more common diseases across the world that is more prevalent in Africa and other tropical places, or I guess along the equator, is malaria. So malaria can affect the red blood cells. That's how it transmits. And if the red blood cell has a more sickle shape or a different shape to it, then maybe the malaria doesn't want to infect it as well. So some scientists theorize that maybe this genetic change occurred as part of evolution and made it harder for malaria to infect people. Malaria tends to occur in these areas across the world where there is more heavily a black population. And so, if this has been going on for generations and generations, thousands of years, then your black population that lives in these areas have been more severely affected. But that does not mean that anybody cannot have this disease. So, it's genetic. So, if you are a black person or a white person, it doesn't mean that you can get this disease equally, depending on who your parents are and who are passing it on.
So, all right, so you've been in this world for a while. Are you optimistic about treatment? Are you optimistic about maybe prevention?
I'm a doctor. I have to be optimistic.
Okay. All right, I'll give you that.
One of the things that's interesting is that I remember, I want to go back to this, my own personal experiences that I remember. I had a person in my life that had sickle cell. They thought that person would pass on when they were 21, but they lived to be 45. So I want to get back to that thing of that statement about stand and treatment. How have treatments changed in the last 20 to 30 years, we're talking about addressing this issue?
So you bring up a valid point that they're now living to 40 something, but that's still not the normal average. So this is an extremely morbid disease, as are others. The treatments have changed because we've learned more about the disease. We've learned more about the genetics. There has been a lot of scientific research in treating with genetics, in treating with making the hemoglobin more stable. So, for instance, 20, 30 years ago, maybe even a little bit longer, the only treatment we had was to give somebody blood that wasn't sickled. So, to transfuse, to give their body good hemoglobin. We know that the life cycle of a red blood cell in a normal body is about 3 to 4 months. Whereas if it is abnormally shaped, then your body's going to break it down or hemolyze it sooner. So in a patient with sickle cell, not only are their red blood cells not lasting as long, but they're then getting transfusions. So when you get a transfusion, it's still not going to last as long because by the time the blood's prepared, it's transfused. It just doesn't last as long in the body. So now you're getting a lot of transfusions. And now you're getting a lot of extra problems that come with getting transfusions. I'm giving you a lot of less extra iron. There's more iron in the blood. So now you have iron overload. Your organs have iron deposited on it. That's the major side effect. But you're also not growing as well. You're not, your whole. Your body's not functioning as well. So what we used to do is treat all the complications that went along with sickle cell by transfusing blood. And if you happen to get a pneumonia, here's the treatment for pneumonia. If you happened to get a spleen problem, your spleen is the one that's breaking down the red blood cells. It's like a sponge. So the more full it gets with degraded blood cells, the less it works. So you're more prone to infections. So now you're dying of diseases. So we're treating those infections. We used to take out spleens. Nowadays, now that we know a little bit more about the genetics of it, they're doing things like gene therapy. Now that is not without risk. I mean, I have to edit your own genome and wipe out your immune system so that your own immune system doesn't attack the new genome. We are giving antibiotics preventatively to prevent infections. We are making sure our patients are vaccinated. We are there are some medicines that we can use. There's an old chemotherapy medicine. Chemo is the term for adjusting your immune system to so it doesn't attack itself, but there's one called hydroxyurea that we have been using for the last 20 to 30 years. That helps to stabilize that hemoglobin shape so it doesn't deform. We've started using that younger and younger so that patients don't develop the severe consequences. So we've started adding in medicines, adding preventative medicines. We've talked about gene therapy. I mean, if you ask me, I don't think the field has moved forward fast enough. I do think there's a lot of racial bias that goes into treatment and into designing treatment, interest in treatment, interest in pharmaceutical companies designing medicines that work. We were fortunate to have a secondary medication that worked similarly to help the hemoglobin attract and hold on to the oxygen, but that was just pulled from the market about a month or 2 months ago, because it had some severe unintended consequences, including death. So there, I'm hopeful that we're going to get places with treatment, but I am also concerned that there's racial bias in and that we don't have enough quick enough.
Thank you for that. Barry, I know that your hand is up. I want to just want to do a real quick follow-up question. I know that I mean, I took a look at the research. Deanna, you did a phenomenal job, but there were some words in there I could not even pronounce, okay? But I did want to talk about anemia. I mean, that's one that you know we talked a lot about how it affects people. But Barry, I don't know. Barry, if you had a question, a different question or a follow-up question, but I just want to I want to make sure that we talk about anemia because that's something that we are I can pronounce that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on where Kate was, just presenting with that and looking at the research. So it seems like on the one hand that really transfusions have remained one of the mainstays of treatments. And so I'm going to do my this is I'm going off script here, guys and gals. A public service announcement because You know, if you need blood transfusions, then that means that someone has to be donating blood. And, you know, in the
Good point.
reality is only 3% of the population are blood donors. And the need for blood is, you know, is great. So that's my public service announcement, is that if you're able, you know, to give blood, think about that, because that's still not only for sickle cell, but also, you know, for some of the other blood disorders that we were talking about, that's in the toolbox. And it's something that we need to be, you know, to recognize and to be cognizant of. And then my other question was that it's sounding like, as the world moves forward, because when I went to medical school, it was always a crisis. You know, these blood disorder was that, you know, that was then. And now, you know, we didn't have gene therapy then. And it's sounding like gene therapy, am I correct, that would be holding the greatest promise for having almost like turning some of these acute diseases into diseases that can be more managed, more like a chronic disease. Because I, you know, you can't be, you know, you can get tr blood transfusions every 3 or 4 months, but eventually, you say iron overload, as you know,
Right.
as you pointed out, that there it's not a benign treatment. It's great to have that available, but I was my question was going to be pointing more toward the horizon for, you know, for some of the gene therapies. And then you pointed out some of the limitations and some of the racial biases that we have that might not make that as high a priority.
Right. I could talk all hour just on
Oh,
anemia, sickle cell related or not.
yeah.
I think there's to back up a bit, when you have sickle cell disease or anemia, it's sickle cell disease causes an anemia. So what is anemia? Anemia is when your red blood cell number, us doctors say hemoglobin because we're lazy and that's just what we call it. But technically, when the red blood cell quantity or number goes down, it's not normal. So if it's not normal, then you're not getting good oxygen carrying capacity, so you're lacking oxygen and starving your tissues. If the cells are abnormally shaped, you're going to break them down or hemolyze them more frequently, so you get a lot of complications related to that. So when you break down a red blood cell, it's your spleen or the big organ on the left side of your body that's doing that. And like I said, it's a sponge, so it's constantly degrading these abnormally shaped red blood cells. And over time, that sponge will get full and stop working. So your spleen is important for fighting infections. It's also important for clearing these red blood cells. So you become at risk for certain infections and very sick infections that can cause death. You also release a lot of bilirubin, which is inside of a red blood cell, when you break it down or hemolyze it. So bilirubin is usually pooped out. Am I allowed to say that on this program? Okay. So it goes to your gallbladder and then it gets pooped out. And if it sits in your gallbladder too long, then you'll cause gallstones. But I think the most severe complications come from really the abnormal shape and plugging up your blood vessels. So if you these blood cells don't flow right through the tubes in your body or the blood vessels, they're going to irritate the lining of your blood vessels and cause pain and cause a lot of inflammation or white blood cells to come in. And they're going to block up your blood vessels. So they're going to cause pain. They're going to cause swelling. And in the case of blocking up your blood vessels in your brain, that's a stroke. So not only can you have silent strokes, so things that occur over time that you might not know about, you can have major strokes. They can plug up the blood vessels in your lungs. That's pneumonia or acute chest syndrome. They plug up your spleen. So there's a lot of side effects that occur just because of this abnormal shape and decreased oxygen carrying capacity. And what we used to do, to speak to Barry's point, is just treat the symptom rather than prevention. And now, in the last 20 or 30 years, we have a few, not as many as I was hoping, to help prevent some of these consequences, infections and strokes and with transfusions. But now we have the ability to really treat or minimize the severity of disease with gene therapy.
So, you know, it's interesting because I, you know, It's like when people have blood disorders, my question is, what do they die from? Okay, so like when you put on a on a death certificate, do you put sickle cell, or do you put a stroke? Okay, it seems like this disease leads to whatever, a heart attack or a stroke, for instance. So I'm just curious how it is that we monitor this, and certainly for research purposes, keeping tabs on how many people have this.
Absolutely. You die from the complications of the
Okay.
disease. I think epidemiologists would argue that you die from the disease. And but when a when somebody writes on a death certificate, they're going to say that you died of a stroke. They might note that you had sickle cell disease, or they might note that you had a bleeding disorder and had a bleeding type stroke, but they might not. And that can hinder our ability to capture these patients and track them. Not that we want to track them, but I guess from a research standpoint, track and see what are the complications, what really are people having, what are they dying from. And that brings a whole nother can of worms that Clarence might want to talk about, is doing research in these populations. These are people who maybe have been a part of some bad research studies in the past, taken advantage of, maybe not as medically literate because they don't have doctors who look like them treating them, and have trust in the, I guess, doctor world. So they're not participating in as many studies and maybe not getting educated. These are also patients who need to come into the clinic frequently for a lot of treatment, and getting to and from the doctor's office might be a hardship. So there's a lot
You know,
of compounding social factors.
I was going to say that you and I had that conversation prior to the starting the program, is that there's so much value lost in the lack of transparency, but also in translation. Doctors are using these big words, other people are using smaller words, and it's almost like it's taboo to translate. And so therefore people do are suspicious. People don't want to participate. And one of the things that, that we're trying with UMAN is to try to erase some of those barriers, because we do need researchers. You do need community members. You know what I'm saying? So we need each other, but it's about how do we have this conversation where we understand that there's not a loss in us talking to each other. So I appreciate you saying that, Kate.
Grace.
Sheridan, you have a comment or two.
I have a question actually, and
Okay.
it's in the same vein of some medical mistrust, and with you being a specialist in pediatric blood disorders, Kate, I was wondering, do you recommend every newborn gets the vitamin K shot, and can you address any misinformation that you've heard in your own practice?
It's a great question. We are going to switch gears now from sickle cell to bleeding disorders. So, we talked about, so to answer your question outright, yes, we do recommend the vitamin K shot to prevent hemorrhagic disease of the newborn. Sorry, hemorrhagic disease of the newborn. I'm going to explain what all those words mean to make Clarence happy and our listeners. We talked previously about the three cells that float through our blood. But then there's all this liquid stuff that is just blood, and we call it plasma as doctors. And inside this plasma or liquid part, you have super, super tiny, tiny little proteins, again, made from your DNA that you inherit from your parents. So these super tiny, tiny little proteins, there are 14 of them that I care about as a blood doctor that we call factors. Why? Because some doctor who discovered them called them factors. That's really the only reason. And these factors are important for building scabs. So they are important to stop bleeding. So the cell called a platelet plugs up holes and initially stops bleeding, but these factors come in and form a scab to prevent ongoing bleeding. And to build these factors, your liver mostly, and some other cells require vitamin K. If you don't have vitamin K, then at least factors 2, 7, 9, and 10, if not others. So at least four of the factors don't have the vitamin that's needed to be built, and therefore you don't make them, and therefore you bleed because they're not there. What happens in a newborn is that when the baby's inside of a mom, the baby relies a lot on what the mom builds. So, they're connected through that umbilical cord. The mom is building all these factors. The mom is keeping the baby safe. But when the baby's born, you cut that umbilical cord, and now the baby's liver says, "Oh my gosh, I have to make these factors. I don't know how. I need time. I need the vitamins. I need the sustenance to build these factors." And if we don't provide that vitamin K at birth, then the baby's liver is left without the vitamin that it needs to build these factors, and then it's at a huge risk to bleed. So way back when, 50 plus years ago, we saw hemorrhagic disease, which is called bleeding disease of the newborn. And it can be devastating. It can cause big bleeds everywhere, especially in the head, which is a major stroke, which is death. So we saw it a lot. And one way that we were able to treat this was to give vitamin K at birth as a shot. So I think there's a lot of disinformation coming from people who maybe don't want to provide these things to their kids, and they have opinions, and everybody is allowed to an opinion. But it is our job as, I guess, doctors to gain trust of our patients and promote good, I would say, safe healthcare choices for their babies, and understand why it's so important.
Wow, I mean, yes, it is important, and trust. I can only imagine when you're dealing with these very, very complicated blood disorders, trust is really key.
Yes.
Couple of other sidebars here. Talk to me about the mental health components to all of this. I can only imagine. That when somebody is diagnosed, it kind of like hits them all of a sudden. So how is it that you deal with these kinds of issues from a mental health perspective, which kind of goes down the road together with the actual disease itself?
Absolutely. I think as a provider, it can be very hard to relay this information to a family because you are telling them that they have a chronic or a lifelong problem, bleeding, clotting, something, and that can affect them in a very difficult way. So then, not only in the pediatric world, are you telling the parents who then need to psychologically accept this? Right, their denial is huge. Accept it, understand it medically, understand the importance of prevention and treatment. And not only that, but then you have to teach the child as they grow. So we are fortunate in most centers to work with patient advocates. Clarence knows one of ours. We are fortunate to work with social workers who are often licensed to help with these psychological acceptance and dealing with things. But we also ask our families as they're aging, as they're going through this, "Hey, do you need to talk to somebody else? Because I'm here, I'm giving you this information, but I'm only taking, if I'm lucky, 80 minutes of your day." Right? This is something you're going to be dealing with. So it can be hard. And we love to connect them with people who maybe either look like them, work with them, live their lives, or can share with this experience and talk about it.
Yeah, I can. I can't imagine. I mean it, but complicated. Clarence, go ahead.
Yeah, I was again thanking you. I'm thanking the researcher for this work, but but she reported there are like 1,000 different kinds of blood disorders.
There's a lot.
Yeah, and I mean I never thought about it. So tell me in your work, the challenges of knowing that. You know, I mean, you got thousands of people, different kinds of people. You got thousands of different personalities and styles. And so tell us a little bit about a day in your life.
Well, maybe through the last 50 years, medicine has changed. Maybe Barry can speak to this as a family medicine trained doc, but you have a patient that comes to your community doctor, family physician, pediatrician, internal medicine doctor, right? These are doctors that see primary care. And then you have now have doctors that have gone through more training to become a specialist. So I'm a specialist. I'm a pediatric hematologist oncologist who is practicing now just hematology, which is blood, not cancer. So you now have doctors over the past so many years who have more training. And then even within that small world of hematology, I tend to just do a lot of bleeding and clotting. So we now are becoming more specially trained. So a day in my life is I have patients that one have to make it to me, be referred or come in with a problem or have a family history of it. That's the hardest part. I have to know enough about everything, all these heme diagnoses, to say, make the diagnosis. And then maybe I work in a center that's fortunate enough to put you with another doctor who has even more training, more specialization in what their problem is. And I don't know. I primarily focus on the world of bleeding and clotting these days, but I'm fortunate to have a job and work in an area that has access to this. Not all patients are as fortunate. They might live in the rural areas, or someplace that doesn't have access to me. So I know a little bit about everything blood related, which is certainly not everything about primary care like Barry. But even within that realm, I focus more so on the bleeding and clotting.
Well, it really
Thank you.
seems like there has to be, correct me if I'm wrong, a real team approach to the delivery of care on this. You, Kate, as a specialist in the arena, and then dealing with your primary care physicians, your pediatricians, and also there's, I would venture to say, not every physician is specialized or trained in these, so they've got to also be, shall I say, educated as well or brought up to speed in order for the team to be effective in the delivery of care. Yeah, Barry, go ahead. You're on mute.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's the point, here is from the family practice perspective, where we know everything, we know nothing about everything. How actually we know a little something about everything, and I think this idea of, especially in dealing with a class of diseases, that there are many causes of them, but yet they impact a relatively small, individually, a relatively small population in the bigger view. So it does become a partnership because, as a family physician, I need to be aware enough to say there's something that's not right here relative to a bleeding disorder, whether it's, too much clotting, not enough clotting. Those kind of things, to be aware of that and to have that timeline of being with a family and having the trust of family to hear that, so that then I could say, this might be something else. It's time to call Kate. It's time to get a Dr. Garland referral here, to really delve into it. But again, then it's the partnership back between the specialist, in this case, back to the primary care or nurse practitioner, whoever that family sees. And these disorders are very much family related, not even from genetics so much, but just from the standpoint for ongoing care, it is a family affair, because you're dealing, these tend to show themselves in childhood, whereas a lot of other diseases tend to show up in adulthood. And so it is that constant back and forth. It's to quote Clarence, is really, it's all about community. And how do you build that community trust to be able to tackle tackle these issues. So that's, sort of where it is that, I could never do my work without having, people like Dr. Garland, who I can refer to figure out what's very, it's very complicated. Again, to get educated about it, of which this show has educated me an awful lot, I have to tell you.
Yeah.
So I've got a couple of questions. Go ahead, Claire. So then I got a couple of other ones here.
I think Barry brings up a great point. This is one of the reasons for our show is that there's just so many twists and turns in terms of talking about medicine, talking about health, talking about this work, that we have to understand that there are roles that people play. And that the more understanding that we have, because, he has to refer to you and you have to come back and you have to give it to him, and he has to be able to translate it to the family and and things like that. And so I think you have to give a little bit of grace in this field, which a lot of times people are just saying, like, I come to you, you tell me what the answer is. But I also thought about the fact that in this process, because of the trust that Barry has built with the family, and he reaches out to you and it comes back to him. It's important for us to have relationships and to be able to talk to one another. And so anyway,
absolutely.
It's just great to be like that.
Yeah. So you need the trust. Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
You need the relationship. And I just wanted to point out that Clarence said it's a process, and that's important. It's a process for the primary care provider to recognize. It's a process even sometimes for me, an excellent hematologist, I'm kidding, to make a diagnosis. So that can be frustrating for families. I need to build trust to be able to I'm a vampire by trade, to draw blood, something so simple. So, I have time. It's a process, and that can be a challenge for families too.
So, I've mentioned on this show, I see knee replacement patients right after they've come out of surgery, because I have had that done. All right. So I'm going to reflect on that.
Okay.
And by the way, the patients greatly appreciate the insight. So now I'm going to ask you the same question for the patients that you see. Okay, somebody has sickle cell, somebody has hemophilia, somebody has anemia. Do you do any connections with others that have had it so that they can help them process? Hey, I'm sickle cell too. And okay, let's talk. Come on, we can do this together. So do you connect patients with one another?
At first, I thought you were going to ask me about knee replacements, and I was going to say, Stan, I'm a pediatrician.
I don't know anything.
To talk about the connections, we do. I think that's our hope. I think we should. I can't speak for everybody, but I want that for the families. I want that for the patients. I want that connection. There are inherent biases in disease processes, whether there are availability for money or a forum for those connections. Trying to get patients connected is a goal. I think as a provider, I need to do my job and make sure that I'm telling patients about these communities and connections. I think I need to educate not only fellow providers in the area, but also families, and have education events. I'm fortunate enough to work with a social worker who also does a lot of that work as well.
So, all right. Other things that kind of popped in my head are like certain medications. So again, patients or just people in general might be on aspirin, okay, which is a blood thinner.
Ooh.
And
sort of.
And I know for a fact that, if patients are on aspirin, I'll just use that as an illustration, and if they're facing surgery, they're told to get off of the aspirin prior to the surgery. So there are certain medications that can affect your blood. So why don't
Yes.
you talk about that a little bit?
So going back to our blood cells and factors. So remember, one of the cells is a platelet, and its job is to plug up a hole to stop the bleed immediately. And the factor's job is to form a scab on top of it so you can heal. So there's two kind of functions there. There are medicines that affect either platelets or factors. So the medicines that affect platelets or stop them from working very well, they limit their function, they inhibit platelets, are things aspirin, or you might have heard of Plavix. These medicines prevent the platelets from working. Whereas there are medicines called blood thinners, and this is why I was giving you a hard time. These blood thinners or anticoagulants are medicines that stop the factors from working.
Gotcha.
So technically, they sort of prevent or stop clotting. They cause bleeding in different ways. So depending on which drug you're on. So for instance, the blood thinners that we typically think about are Coumadin or warfarin. There's some newer ones called Xarelto or Eliquis. There's Lovenox shots. There's a ton of them. They all have different mechanisms of actions. So you have to stop them before a surgery in different ways. So a platelet medicine, you might want to stop maybe 5 to 10 days before a surgery. Whereas a blood thinner, depending on which one you're on, you might want to stop 2 days before a surgery.
Thank you for that clarification.
You're
That's an
welcome.
important one, and I hope the listening audience heard that as well. So I became knowledgeable about that. So the other thing I want to talk about is call them comorbid manifestations here. So let's just say somebody's diabetic, and then all of a sudden they're also anemic. How do we deal with these types of situations?
Can be a challenge. And going back to Barry and Clarence's point, it takes a village to manage patients. You know, unfortunately, diabetes is more common and becoming more common in children. So pediatricians are having to become more knowledgeable about it. But previously, it had mostly been followed by endocrinologists, another subspecialist. So now you have two different subspecialists, or maybe three doctors involved in their care. And what I do is I try to stay educated on things and I talk to other providers. Hey, I'm going to fix your anemia, but how is it going to affect your diabetes management?
Okay. Then I guess I'd be remiss to not bring up, and we brought this up in other shows too, things that hit us as human beings. COVID, for instance. All of a sudden, whoa, everybody's hit with that. So tell me how you as a practitioner in this area had to deal with COVID vis-a-vis patients that were dealing with blood disorders, and on the other hand, now they have COVID.
It was scary. I think it
Okay.
was scary for providers and scary for patients because initially, you know, we just didn't know. I think what we understood quickly is that COVID itself as a virus caused a lot of inflammation, swelling, reaction of the immune system. And when that happens, the major side effect from a hematologist standpoint is that it causes clotting. So, when you have a lot of inflammation, not only is it going to cause clotting, but it's going to trigger your underlying disease. So, if you have an underlying abnormal shaped red blood cell like sickle cell, it's going to trigger them to sickle. So, now you're going to experience worsening
Thanks.
complications of sickle cell disease on top of clotting. So, I mean, as a initially, we were throwing blood thinners at everybody to prevent blood clots who was hospitalized. We still do. And we were learning more and more about how to treat COVID. So we were throwing steroids at them to decrease inflammation and swelling. We were using antibody therapy because if you get a blood clot, especially in your head or in your belly or your leg, I mean, that can be life-threatening too. It's scary.
Wow, yeah. So it's stuff that comes that hits us that good or bad, we have to deal with. This has been really enlightening. I learned quite a bit on this show, and you know, I greatly appreciate it. I greatly appreciate you as a clinician in this arena, and we're lucky to have you. And
thank you.
It's really nice. Barry, last thoughts.
Yeah, I'm going to keep it brief here. This was really amazing, and from the perspective of bleeding disorders, the ground that we covered and the perspectives that were presented, I thought were really very educational, very helpful, and were explained extremely clearly. And so I thank Dr. Garland for being a guest on our show. And who knew that bleeding disorders could be so fascinating and interesting and cover such a wide base of things. But that's what I have to say. So thank you.
Thank you.
Clarence.
Well, we often talk about sending shows out to our family and friends. And as we were going through this show, my mind started racing about all the people that should be listening to this show. And so I just want to thank you for your insight and for your information. And, you know, thank you for your transparency. And it was good. It was a good show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sheridan, I know that you chimed in. Any thoughts?
I appreciate you answering my question. That was not in the research. I really did kind of put you on the spot there. So I both apologize and say okay. Thank you at the same time. You obviously knew where I was going with that. I have a quick question, a fun fact. Do you want to tell the audience why it's called vitamin K? Do you know?
Vitamin K. You are putting me on the spot.
I think
did you do the research?
No, Deandra did. I just have been seeing a lot of stuff about vitamin K, and I think it comes from the German word coagulation. Oh,
coagulations vitamin, and I'm not going to pronounce that in German correctly. You are correct.
Yeah. So all the other vitamins A through E were named in like order, and then mm-hmm. I think coagulation and K just makes sense. So next time anybody asks you about the vitamin K shot, you can think coagulation.
Thank you.
And you can think Sheridan too.
I know. I never thought to ask.
I always thought the vitamin K shot with a C. You know, but anyway, it's okay.
Well, listen, this has been really enlightening. I thank you very much for not only being on our show, but being in our community.
Anytime.
It would be, and I always tell our guests, as things come up, especially for you as a researcher, that you believe we should get some words out, you just give us a call and we'll get you back onto Health Chatter.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So for our listening audience, great shows come up. Our next one, interestingly enough, will be on pharmacy deserts, which also is kind of become more of a problem in dealing with health overall. In the meantime, everybody keep health chatting away.